This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. The case of Nagendran Dharmalingam, a 33-year-old Malaysian on death row in Singapore for drug trafficking offences, has thrown a spotlight on the issue of the death penalty and raises the question of whether it even has a place in our society today. So we're discussing this case with Kirsten Han, a freelance journalist in Singapore and an advocate for abolishing the death penalty. Thanks for joining us today, Kirsten.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start with, I suppose, a background of the case? How did you come to know of Nagendran's case, and what makes his situation unique from other death row prisoners that you've advocated for in the past?
So I'd heard of Nagin's case on and off for a few years, but I wasn't very intimately acquainted with it. And then on the 28th of October this year, after almost 2 years of there being no executions in Singapore, I saw that the execution notice for Nagin had been sent to his family, and it was circulating on social media. And so very soon after that, I was put in touch with his sister because the family needed help with the arrangements to come to Singapore. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of overarching issues with the death penalty and drug policy present in Nagin's case. But I think what set it apart for me and for a lot of people is that he only has borderline intellectual functioning. So the court did accept that his IQ was only 69 and that he had impairments related to executive functioning. And so it's shocking that we would want to hang such a vulnerable person. And I think other factors that stood out to people was that we were also going to do it over the Deepavali period and in the middle of a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Why have the Singapore courts rejected arguments to take into account Nagendran's mental impairments? I mean, the fact that he has an IQ of below 100, it seems quite clear that this should be taken into account.
Yeah, so it's the way that the law has been written. So under the Misuse of Drugs Act, that carve out is if you have an abnormality of mind that would affect your mental responsibility for the offense that was committed. So the court found that his borderline intellectual functioning wasn't actually enough to satisfy that requirement. So they found that, you know, although he has borderline intellectual functioning, it didn't fulfill the requirement of what would be considered abnormality of mind under the law. And also that because he could tell right from wrong, therefore he's culpable for the offense. So actually, the way that this law is written doesn't give a lot of leeway to consider mitigating circumstances. It's just a very specific criteria that needs to be filled.
And it sounds like a very high threshold that needs to be crossed in order for mental illness or impairments to actually be counted as a mitigating factor.
Yeah, so it is quite a high threshold because there are all these different limbs that you have to satisfy. So, you know, first you have to prove that you have abnormality of mind, then you have to show that, you know, it impaired your mental responsibility for the offense. And mental responsibility is quite hard to really determine that, right? So it's just this whole, for example, with Nagin, they said, oh, he can tell right from wrong and therefore, you know, he's culpable. But, you know, even if that's true, for someone with borderline intellectual functioning, the way his reasoning works, mm-hmm. it's not the same.
Mm. It doesn't take into account the ways that he may have reacted to pressure differently than somebody with a presumed normal mental functioning.
Yes, that's right.
Let's talk about the timeline of events. Could you maybe give us a quick run-through of what happened? And my question really is in terms of, I guess, the delays that we saw from when he was first sentenced to his final notification of execution. I mean, I think he was sentenced back in 2011, but it wasn't until this year that the notice actually came out.
Yeah, so Nagin was arrested in 2009, and then he was first sentenced to death by the High Court in 2010. Then in 2011, he had his appeal rejected by the Court of Appeal. After that, though, in 2012, Parliament passed amendments to the Misuse of Drugs Act, which included, you know, very specific and narrow criteria in which the courts could choose to sentence people to life imprisonment with or without caning, mm-hmm. instead of the death penalty. So like many others on death row, Nagin became eligible for resentencing. So he tried to apply to be resentenced, and he also made other applications to the court, including seeking a judicial review of a prosecution decision not to grant him a certificate of substantive assistance, mm-hmm. which would have helped him get resentenced. So these cases all kind of took time to go through the courts. And apart from that, we don't know very much about how the authorities schedule executions, but also there were no executions last year, particularly because there were other challenges in court that could have affected multiple inmates. So actually, all the kind of executions were put on hold.
I see. Okay. So in the intervening years from 2011, when his first appeal was rejected, and 2012, when there was a reform of the law, there were efforts to get him resentenced, to look at his case again. And I can see why that took time. But in contrast, we also saw that there was a rush to process the execution appeal within 24 hours when the notice of execution first came out. So it just seems like there's a difference between one process and another.
Yes, so it seems quite odd. Like, so for example, after his execution notice came out, and then there was a application to the High Court that was made, and that was heard on the Monday, which I believe is the 8th of November. Mm-hmm. And then that appeal was dismissed. And when his lawyer said, "I would like to appeal that to the High Court," they scheduled the appeal for the very next day, the 9th of November, mm-hmm. because his execution was supposed to be on the 10th. So it does seem like once an execution notice is out, there is a lot of prioritizing that they keep to that date. Mm-hmm. So they're very insistent that once we decide we will execute on this date, we are going to meet that deadline, and we're going to, you know, like, so mm-hmm. there's a lot of this kind of, oh, it's about the efficiency of the system as well.
Right. And as we know, the execution has been stayed, but not for reasons due to the appeal. We found out that Nagindran has contracted COVID-19, and therefore the court decided that they would temporarily stay, or the appeal is postponed, essentially. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So we don't know when the new date will be yet.
And at this stage, is he in indefinite limbo then? What do we know about his situation at the moment, that he has COVID-19? Is he getting treatment? Is there anything that we know about that?
So from what we can gather from press releases from the prison, he is asymptomatic and well, but the entire kind of section of the prison in which death row is situated is currently on lockdown. Because after the news came out that Nagin was COVID positive, later that night and the next day, they came out and said, actually, in that part of the prison, Institution A1, there are 116 COVID cases.
Wow.
So that part of the prison has currently been locked down. And you know, they say, like, if you're COVID positive, you're isolated. But it's not very clear the details of what this isolation is, because technically, if you think about it, prisoners on death row are already isolated. Right. They're in single cells. Yeah, so we don't really know much more beyond that.
I see. And you've written about the bureaucratic nightmare that Nagindran's family had to navigate in order to visit him prior to his execution date. What was this down to, pandemic restrictions? I mean, essentially, was the difficulty because travel between countries is restricted at the moment?
Yeah, so it can actually always be difficult for a family to travel to Singapore, especially if they aren't a well-off family. So in 2016, we had to raise money to fly a family from Miri in Sarawak over to Singapore. And at other times, we've also had to help pay for accommodation or other expenses for families to come and stay. But this one was just so much worse because of the pandemic restrictions. So there is no vaccinated travel lane between Malaysia and Singapore at the moment. That's only like coming later this month. So they had to jump through more hoops at very, very short notice, right? So they were only given about 2 weeks notice. Mm-hmm. And in that time, they had to figure out how to take leave from work, figure out which family member actually could get their leave approved and could actually travel. And then we had to book flights. We had to book the COVID PCR test,
mm-hmm.
apply for entry approval, make health declarations, and also find accommodation for them to quarantine in when they aren't at the prison visiting Nagin. So what was arranged for them is that while people coming in from Malaysia have to serve like a 10-day quarantine,
mm-hmm.
they were allowed to leave the quarantine, but only to go to the prison to see him. So every time that they came back from the prison, they could only go back straight to the hotel and stay in their rooms.
Right.
So we couldn't just book any hotel. We had to book hotels that were also set up to like accept this sort of quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to like grab food, their own food, because they just couldn't leave their rooms, and then they had to just order their own food. So that was a lot to kind of wrap your head around at very short notice, especially mm-hmm. when the family was already really distressed because of the news. And it was also expensive. Like, so if we didn't crowdfund in Singapore, the family would not have been able to afford to come. So just to give an idea, for the trip to Singapore that they came, four family members came for, as including like a few other expenses such as legal costs or filing fees that was covered, we've spent over Singapore $9,000.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is in order to help the family see their son before he's due to be executed. It's such a sobering story, Kirsten. We'll discuss more after the quick break. I'm speaking to Kirsten Han, freelance journalist and human rights activist based in Singapore. Is the death penalty actually effective in preventing drug crimes? We'll discuss this after the break, only on BFM 89.9. Hello, this is Pressing Matters on the Morning Run. I'm Shazana, and with me on the show today is freelance journalist and human rights activist Kirsten Han. Kirsten is a longtime advocate for the abolition of the death penalty in Singapore, and she's been following Nagendran Damarlingam's case, the Malaysian man currently on death row. Kirsten, Singapore, like Malaysia, has very strict drug laws, which the government says is necessary to keep citizens safe. And this includes the mandatory death penalty for possession of drugs. You, however, disagree with this premise. Why do you say the zero tolerance approach is harmful, particularly when it comes to drug offenses?
So there isn't actually any evidence that, you know, drug policy experts and researchers have found to say that the death penalty actually deters these sorts of drugs offenses. You know, there are no kind of conclusive evidence that they've found to say that, you know, executing people actually is more effective than other punishments in deterring crime. And so there's no actual proof that this approach that we believe works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also itself causing a lot of harm, right? It's a very brutal, violent system. And it causes harm to the people who are policed and who are arrested, who are jailed, who are sent to, we have drug rehabilitation centers in Singapore that really, from what we are told by people who've been there, is just prison by another name.
Mm.
And so that creates its own harm.
There is an emotive argument that harsh sentences are justice for those who have been wronged by drug traffickers or drug dealers. I mean, how would you counter this view?
Yeah, so this is said a lot, right? But what we don't often hear are the voices of these families and drug users or ex-users. So it's always people are like speaking for them and saying, oh, you know, think about them, they're the victims. But we don't get to hear from them. We don't get to hear complex narratives or in-depth narratives. The only time we hear from them is when, you know, the mainstream media or the government trots out a story of someone who talks about their redemption arc, right?
Mm.
So I think there's a lot more space that we should be giving to hear these kind of complex stories about why people might choose to use drugs, the reality of using drugs, and what they feel would help them. So with the Transformative Justice Collective, which is a group that I'm with, we do try to kind of highlight these narratives. And so recently, actually, there was a solidarity statement
mm-hmm.
issued by drug users, ex-users, and their loved ones to stand in solidarity with Nagin
mm-hmm.
to say that, you know, the story resonates with them because they see themselves in this sort of case. You know, there are a lot of reasons why they might you know, choose to use drugs or end up in the drug trade. And we actually don't hear these reasons. So it's not true that anti-death penalty activists like me don't care about victims and families, but we see that there is a much deeper story in there that's not being listened to.
Right. And it doesn't really address the root causes of why, like you said, people would get involved in drug use or drug trafficking. And in the end, it doesn't really address those causes, meaning that it doesn't eradicate the problem entirely in the end.
Definitely. Yeah. So there are a lot of social economic factors that we are not addressing when we just use things like the death penalty.
Now, I guess in the mid-2000s, there was a public survey by the Straits Times that showed an overwhelming majority of Singaporeans actually supported the death penalty. What do you see as the sentiment today? Does that sentiment still hold true, that the death penalty has a lot of support?
It's true that the death penalty still has a lot of support, but it's a much more nuanced picture than we get from these sorts of straw poll type of surveys. Mm-hmm. So there was a study done by legal scholars at the National University of Singapore and Singapore Management University, and they published a working paper in 2018. And they had administered this questionnaire surveying public opinion on the death penalty using the same sort of questionnaire that was used in Malaysia. So it's actually you can compare the results between the two countries. Mm-hmm. And in Singapore, they found that while it's true that if you ask people, you know, do you support the death penalty or not, majority will say yes. But when you add more detail to this, there is actually, you will see that the support is not as clear cut mm-hmm. as you might assume. So for instance, even though people say that they support the death penalty, when you ask them if they support the mandatory death penalty for drugs, that percentage of support drops. It actually goes below 50%. Mm-hmm. And if you present them with specific kind of cases with details, people tend to like not pick the death sentence, or like the support for the death penalty is actually lower mm-hmm. when they are looking at specific cases, even if it's still above 50%, than it would be if you just ask them this sort of theoretical question. So I think the issue in Singapore is that there isn't a lot of public knowledge or education about the death penalty, how it works and who it affects.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose in that sense, in order to create this kind of mind shift, sort of change people's perceptions about the death penalty being effective, it's really about creating that space for debate and discussion. Do you see that there is more room for this kind of debate in Singapore?
There is a little bit of room for this sort of debate. And it's an improvement compared to what we had, you know, 10, 15, 20 years before when, you know, things would actually, theatre shows that mention the death penalty, for instance, would actively get censored. Mm. So today it's better. It's still not a lot of space. Like, we don't get to have these sorts of discussions in the mainstream media. So a lot of it is happening in pockets of spaces online and social media, which doesn't have as wide a reach. Mm-hmm. But at least it's happening. Yeah. Mm.
And I guess, do you see, how has the Singaporean public reacted to Nagendran's case? I mean, we're focused on how the Malaysians see it, but from Singapore's side, is there, what kind of discourse are you seeing?
So there's a lot of the usual discourse of, you know, hang drug traffickers, drugs are bad. So there's that, but there's also been an outpouring of support and sympathy. I was really surprised, actually, when we launched a crowdfunding campaign trying to crowdfund the money so that the family could come. We exceeded our target within 24 hours, and exceeded by quite a lot, like almost going to be double. Mm-hmm. So there were just a lot of people who were just giving money, like $20, $30, $50, $100 mm-hmm. to support this family to come. And in previous cases, when we crowdfunded, you kind of get a sense of who will give, right? Like it's such a small circle that you actually know who's going to give money. But in this case, it was like so many people mm-hmm. and most of them, I didn't know them. So it was just, you know, members of the public.
It went beyond
the family.
It went beyond the usual suspects, right?
Yes.
Well, Kristen, I think that on that note, we'll end our call today. And thank you so much for speaking to us. We'll definitely catch up with you as more news about Nagendran's case comes out. We're hoping for, a positive outcome. I've been speaking to Kristen Han, freelance journalist and curator of the newsletter We the Citizens, which covers Singapore issues. You can look up the newsletter We the Citizens. Now, this has been Pressing Matters on the Morning Run. Coming up next, we have the 10 a.m. News Bulletin. And then after that, Enterprise. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.